This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Write what you know. That's what aspiring authors are told to do. Our guest, Matt Gallagher, began writing a popular, controversial, darkly funny, and irreverent blog, Kaboom, when he was stationed in Iraq from 2007 to 2009. He had many readers on the front, including, I read, General David Petraeus, but that didn't stop the military from shutting the blog down. Gallagher's 2010 memoir, Kaboom, Embracing the Suck in a Savage Little War, was about his time as an Army cavalry officer stationed outside of Baghdad. His latest book is a novel, Youngblood, and it's about a young Army platoon lieutenant sent to Iraq as the war is winding down. He has to deal with a trigger-happy sergeant, a mysterious murder, a love affair, and the, quote, moral ambiguities of war, when it's hard to know who is friend and who is foe, what is right and what is wrong. We asked Matt Gallagher to join us today on Radio Times, and he's with us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Matt, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me again, Marty.
You're very welcome. I'd love to have you read from the very beginning, from the prologue of your new book.
Sure. It's strange trying to remember now. Not the war, though that's all tangled up too. I mean the other parts. The way sand pebbles nipped at our faces in the wind. How the mothers glared when we raided houses looking for their sons. The smell of farm animal waste and car exhaust blending together during patrols through town, rambling, aimless hours lost to the desert. How falafel bits got stuck between my teeth so much I started bringing floss on missions, along with extra ammo and water. The sun, the goddamn heat, the days I couldn't sleep and the nights I wouldn't. How the power of being in charge got to me, how it got to all the officers and sergeants. Giant armed soldiers at our backs, ready to carry out foreign policy through sheer force. How sometimes, many times, we were gentle. The feeling of something, relief, gratitude, exhaustion, when a patrol returned to the outpost, and for another day, we'd be able to ask ourselves just what the hell were we doing. So little of Iraq had anything to do with guns or bombs or jihads. That's what people never understand. There was the desert, and the locals, and their lives. The way time could be vague and hazy one moment, yet hard as bone the next. A lot of people ask, what was it like? And once, I even tried to answer. I was home, with old friends. They meant well, and while they didn't want a perfect story, they wanted a clean one. It's what everyone wants, and I knew that. But it came out wrong. I started off about Imperial grunts walking over a past we didn't know anything about, but I could see their eyes glazing over, so I switched to the Iraqi kids playing in mud under bent utility poles, but that didn't work either. An anecdote about finding a sheik's porn collection earned some laughs, but by then I'd lost them, so I stopped. What's an Imperial grunt? One asked later. They help the SEALs get bin Laden? Kind of, I said, even though we hadn't. I miss it. Which is a funny thing to think until I remember otherwise. Like the daily purpose, I miss that, as messy as it could be. I miss the clarity of trying to survive. I miss the soldiers. Even miss the Mukhtar, who was honest enough to hate us, but still made us chai, because we were guests. And her, of course. She comes in fragments, slivers of jagged memory that cut and condemn. How she'd sigh before we talked about the past. How my mind ached after we considered the future. I failed Rana, failed her utterly, all because I tried to help. What was it like? Hell if I know. But next time someone asks, I won't answer straight and clean. I'll answer crooked, and I'll answer long. And when they get confused or angry, I'll smile. Finally, I'll think, someone who understands.
And that's our guest, Matt Gallagher, reading from the prologue, the very beginning of his new book, a novel called Youngblood. I really like the way you begin this book, and it feels, especially to hear you read it, as if this is you talking and not your central character.
Right. No, having written a memoir before, I think I'd kind of gotten that out of my system. So when I started this novel, you know, it originally started in third person, but I think first person offers kind of this deeper emotional texture that I felt was important to this narrative and important to this story. So I started constructing this character, Jack Porter, who is very different than me in many ways. We maybe share some biographical details, but I think readers and listeners can get a sense of things really stick to him, and he really chews them over, sometimes to his detriment. For better or worse, I compartmentalize. I don't think it's a spoiler to say Jack does not compartmentalize his war experience.
As I said, I really love this, and just the sensory details as this person, this character thinks of Iraq. It's about what it smelled like, how hot it was, the falafel stuck between his teeth, those tiny little sensual details that have so much meaning.
Absolutely, yeah. Capturing kind of the day-to-day travails of this portion of the war, and just the experience of being a human being, both a foreign occupier and an everyday Iraqi citizen in this world after 9 years of war and occupation was very important mm-hmm. to me. And I'll admit that sometimes I went back to my old blog writings,
right?
Yeah, to get a sense of what it was like in the moment, rather than maybe how a creative writing student remembers it being 5-6 years later, because as we all know, memory can distort and warp.
Absolutely. You're right. I miss it, which is a funny thing to think until I remember otherwise, like the daily purpose. I mean, missing to be on a mission, to be with your platoon, to be in the midst of this chaotic, confusing, scary war.
Sure. Clarity is something I think we all grapple for in life, Jack in this case kind of longs for that purpose of a very specific thing of going out of the wire with a tribe of like-minded souls with a very clear intent, right? It's focus on what you can control in this small town. As a platoon, as a junior officer in this case, he can't really affect the macro war. And, the story of Youngblood very much is him searching for something he can control. He wants to find one thing that he can do for the better in the midst of this giant American withdrawal that he has deep misgivings about.
Is this book an answer to that question, which I certainly have asked as an interviewer, and I'm sure you've been asked untold numbers of times, what was it like? I mean, that question... And perhaps the impossibility of explaining, or perhaps using fiction, which can get you maybe closer to what it was like than reading something in a newspaper or on a blog, even.
It was definitely part of it. I wanted the novel to kind of be a reckoning of what that 9 year war and occupation had meant, not just on the individual souls of people, be them the American soldiers deployed there, sometimes redeployed there 3-4 times. Or the everyday Iraqi citizen and their families just trying to endure and survive, and the moral and psychological toll that would take on anyone, but also the effect on this one Iraqi community, the town of Ashuria, that I think can serve as a microcosm for the country as a whole.
Is that a real place?
It's not. It's not. It's a fictional town right along the sectarian border. And there are many towns just like it in and around Baghdad, but creating a town in these pages, allowed me some latitude to maybe stray from the sticky facts, but still stay true to the emotional truths.
Tell us about Jack Porter. He's your lieutenant. How you conceived of him, how you think about him, how you want your readers to think about him.
I wanted him to kind of function as a cipher in many ways. This is his first tour.
He's young.
He's very young, wide, clear-eyed. Thinks he knows a fair amount about Iraq as a culture and society and the war. His older brother has deployed and was awarded the Silver Star. So in many ways, Jack joined the military to try to live up to his brother's example. He shows up. This is about 2010 or so, a few years after I was there, as the American military is preparing to withdraw. So he, having those clear eyes, kind of gives him a real fresh sense of what the preceding years have done to people, to this community. Then kind of putting him in contrast with the de facto antagonist, Staff Sergeant Daniel Chambers, who's on his fourth tour. who survived. You know, who's yes, he's a bit of a Machiavellian, you know, he's the hero of his own story, I think. You know, kind of putting these two in the same environment and having them explore these questions of moral courage and physical courage, in many ways, I think, kind of mirrored the duality of the American military experience in Iraq, right? Be part soldier, be part nation builder, drinking chai one moment, getting caught up in a firefight the next. You know, having these two men who I think share some similar goals and ambitions, just disagree on the means of carrying that out. It just felt right.
Well, and this Daniel Chambers, he's a sergeant, and in many ways, it seems that Jack Porter sees him as a threat, maybe to his authority as the head of this group. He's got tattoos, in a sense, almost like notches for every Iraqi or every person that he has killed. Do you think, and he mixes things up, and some of the men are attracted to this guy because he's loud and he's macho and he's got all these tattoos, and you've got this green Jack Porter trying to figure out how to deal with him.
Yeah, no, I wanted to kind of play with the common stereotype, I think, of when Americans think of, you know, the hard-ass, battle-hardened sergeant. Everyone pictures Tom Berenger from Platoon. So, you know, I wanted to introduce Chambers that way, but then kind of explore the deeper ambiguities, the reasons why he's that way and presents himself this way. And, you know, he's a survivor. This is his fourth tour to the desert. He's been in this exact same town before. He has his reasons. You know, for him, all that matters is bringing his soldiers home. And, you know, if I were the spouse or a parent of one of those young soldiers, you know, what more could you want? From a platoon sergeant in charge of your young person. On the other hand, you know, that's going to conflict with the higher mission, particularly when that higher mission part of it is charging these soldiers with protecting the local Iraqi townspeople. So, you know, these are the questions that Jack finds himself having to explore and not having any experience to fall back on. So kind of wrestling with the moral quandaries of all this is a central part of Youngblood.
We're almost up on a break here. Did you have a Daniel Chambers when you were in Iraq? Someone like that?
You encounter people like that in the military, and frankly, it's a good thing. The military needs more Sergeant Chambers than they need Jack Porters.
More than a Jack Porter.
Yeah, but they still need Jack Porters too. And I think Chambers and Jack have trouble reconciling that they're really both necessary to this place and in this time.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Matt Gallagher is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. In fact, was a guest a couple of years ago when he and a co-author came in and talked about a short story, collection of short stories that they had co-authored and also edited about Iraq. He's now got a novel, his first novel, and it's called Youngblood. We're going to take a very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Matt Gallagher about his debut novel. It's called Youngblood, and it's set in Iraq as the U.S. Military begins its withdrawal from that country. I should add that our guest, Matt Gallagher, was an Army platoon leader in Iraq from 2007 till the beginning of 2009. Why did you want to set the story as the Americans were leaving? Why, that wasn't exactly when you were there, but why put it at that time?
Well, I'd already written a lot of nonfiction about my own experiences and kind of the micro story of you know, one man's war, one platoon's war. So when I set out to do a novel, you know, I wanted to do something with more fullness, maybe a sense of totality of the 9-year war. So setting it near the end of the withdrawal seemed right because it allowed me a space to kind of look back and take it all in. That said, because it was after I was there, it required me to do a lot of research to see how the war had changed and evolved It seems quaint now, but when we went home in early 2009, we felt like we'd won the war.
Really?
Wars like Iraq can be won, or at least a corner had been turned. Through the research I did, through interviews with veterans who were over there after us in 2010 and 2011, there was much more of a sense of preemptive victory, that we were leaving things unsettled, kind of capturing that within the characters and pages of Youngblood just needed to be done as a result.
And of course, these characters, they don't know what has happened to Iraq. And as far as they're concerned, it's obviously trying to survive a difficult situation, but also dealing with the locals, with the Sunnis and the Shia and some of the conflicts there, and trying to figure out, is this person my ally? Are they going to turn on me? Just the sense of anxiety and uncertainty about who you're dealing with and what could happen next.
Right. There's a line when Chambers is sharing a story with a platoon.
This is the sergeant, yes.
Right, from 2006, actually, during the height of the sectarian wars. And he says it was everyone against everyone and everyone against us. In some ways, that's changed a couple years later, at least at first glance. In many other ways, it's all still bubbling under the surface. And I wanted to kind of capture the fact that the civil war that we'd helped suppress in 2007 and 2008, albeit a civil war that we helped initiate some years before, that was still all there under the surface. And obviously, in the preceding years, we've seen it return to at least parts of the country.
Lots of kids, lots of interactions with civilians. You have a character, a young Iraqi boy, the Barbie kid. Mm-hmm. Who is this?
He's a young Iraqi orphan that makes ends meet by selling energy drinks and pornography to American soldiers and Iraqi townspeople. And Iraq has a lot of Barbie kids, right? Young people who know nothing but war and strife, have grown up in the midst of this, and aren't children the way that I think we tend to think of them over here in America. They never had any innocence. It's not that they could even lose any innocence. So conveying that in the Barbie kid was important. Having full dimensional Iraqi characters was important for this book, not just because it was part of my experience as the author, though it was, but because it's not really about us. We often view these conflicts and through an American only prism. Iraq is so much more than just kind of this desert full of bomb craters. It's full of neighborhoods. It's full of people that have had to deal with this for over a decade now. So capturing that and humanizing that in these pages was important to me as a writer.
There's also a love story in here. Mm-hmm. It should be said, one of the soldiers has fallen in love with a local woman. I mean, there's some sort of mystery about what has happened to him, but nonetheless, a real love affair there. Was that something that happened in Iraq? I mean, was there enough contact, interaction with locals, and including local women? Or is this your fantasy?
It's funny because that's a standard trope, I think, from previous wars and iterations of war literature.
The people fall in love in war.
Correct, yes, and falling in love with a local. It's something that had been unexplored in Iraq and Afghanistan literature for, I think, some obvious reasons, the societal and cultural barriers. Was it possible? Yes. Was it common? Certainly not. As I did some research, there were just enough instances of American soldiers marrying local women, often interpreters, but not always the case, that I felt I could pursue this. And because Jack's hearing about this romance 5-6 years later after it happened, it felt less important to me that it actually happened the way the stories tell it, but more important that he, like the reader, are asking these very same questions. Is this even possible? How could this happen in this town of Asharia? Exploring that and coming at it kind of sideways a few years later, just worked from a literary perspective.
Well, Jack Porter has a girlfriend back home. Marissa. Mm-hmm. I'd actually love to have you read a section from the book. And this is he's kind of fantasizing about his sexual encounter with her. And I'd just love to have you read this.
Sure. The first time Marissa and I had slept together, we'd been on the slide of a neighborhood park underneath a row of cedars and a black well of sky. We'd called it a midnight brunch, a bottle of cheap red wine and grilled cheese sandwiches wrapped in tin foil. I'd collected together a few blades of grass, two dandelions and a three-leaf clover, and handed her the bouquet with ironic flourish. Not bad for a high school senior. "Mr. Romance," she said, pulling me down with resolve, her soft lips filling my mouth. She hadn't responded to my emails in a few weeks. Maybe I'd come across as too needy. Facebook said she was in a relationship. Or maybe I'd come across as not needy enough. Back when I had civilian hair, shaggy brown like a beetle, she'd made me use coconut-scented shampoo because she said it smelled nice. As long as she wasn't back together with that lerp she dated before me, I was cool with it. He was a real estate agent now, for Christ's sake. Or that orangutan of a dental student. He had bad gums. Or that tennis player with spiky hair. He smiled too much. What a clown. Anyone but that guy. I tried thinking about some of the others, like the Danish tourist I'd met in Honolulu the year before, who'd called me the wrong name the next morning. Sometimes she was the answer, but not this time. I kept my eyes closed and breathed in a cloud of mango, and Marissa's body went up and down that slide, and up and down. My pants went up and down, and my hand went down, and...
And he gets interrupted there.
He does, yes.
I like that scene only because what sort of leads up to it is a bit of a miscommunication argument. I mean, the difficulty, I guess, of having, maintaining a girlfriend when or boyfriend if someone is overseas. Yes, you get to Skype with them. Yes, you get to email with them. But how difficult it is to maintain that kind of connection.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the interesting things about technology and these wars is that almost false sense of connection.
False sense. I mean, yes, you can. You don't have to wait for a letter to arrive, right?
Right, but you know, you hear these horror stories of being on Skype calls and spouses back home hearing mortar rounds coming down, and you know the soldier obviously has to go. Horror stories of spouses finding out through Facebook that they've lost a loved one before the military chaplain has arrived, because soldiers back over there in Iraq and Afghanistan are posting about it. And you know, I kind of wanted to capture a bit of that in terms of you know, obviously you have all the demands and baggage of the moment in the combat zone, but because of this technology. All the needs and demands of life back home compound as well, and I saw it happen to a lot of my soldiers when I was over there. So I felt bad doing this to Jack and Marissa because they were characters I cared about,
right.
But it was nuanced and stripping Jack away from his past life layer by layer, and I think this his fallout with Marissa is one of those layers was important to the story, because then he'd be he's laid bare by the end of it and has nothing left, or at least he thinks he has nothing left but Iraq and this moment.
This may be too personal a question. Did you have a girlfriend when you were in Iraq?
I did, but it was a happy story.
It was a happy.
Yes.
So are you happy meaning that?
Oh, she's my wife now.
She's your wife now.
Yes.
Okay. So a little different from fiction.
Very much so. And much like Kaboom, I think it was a story where a lot of things went right. Right place, right time, luck and circumstance. I think Youngblood is much more a story where a lot of things go wrong.
Yeah.
That just allowed me to kind of explore maybe the darker corners of the war that I knew about in my own tour, but luckily enough didn't really deal with too much.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Matt Gallagher, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. A couple of years ago, he was a guest on Radio Times talking about a collection of short stories called Fire and Forget, short stories from the Long War. He also wrote a memoir a couple of years ago called Kaboom, Embracing the Suck in a Savage Little War. And now he's got a novel, his first, and it's called Youngblood. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Jack Porter has an interpreter, as I'm assuming most military people, certainly journalists had when they were in Iraq, a guy named Kasim, whose nickname is Snoop. Tell us about Kasim.
Well, he's originally from the Sudan, and he learned to speak English through a combination of British missionaries and gangster rap. So he's even younger than many of the soldiers are in the platoon, and having him be a full, vibrant character was an excellent opportunity, I think, to explore this world, because you know he's a foreigner himself, but he's not quite a foreign occupier the way the soldiers are, but he's aligned with them. In many ways, Jack's not always cognizant of it, but Snoop is the only one always there for him. Kasim is and Snoop, they function as not just a translator for Jack in terms of the language, but he's often a cultural interpreter for the reader as well, to kind of reorient us as we explore this strange land and foreign people.
And I mean, I would think interpreters, I've never had one, but an interpreter just plays such an important role. I mean, how dependent, in this case, Jack or anybody would be on someone explaining, did they carefully and correctly interpret what I said, what someone has said back to me, the kind of dependence that you have to have on someone who is your interpreter.
Absolutely. I mean, every day and every night they go on every patrol. One of the best men I've ever met was my own interpreter.
Is that right?
Yeah, he was a much older man, early 50s actually. The physical demands of patrolling during a counterinsurgency were immense, but he was always there.
Why do you think?
I think mostly to provide for his family. I'd like to think that some of the things he said about believing in a new Iraq were true, but I could understand if he had a lot of skepticism about that. There was a small but vibrant Sudanese population in Baghdad proper, but he kept what he was doing from his family because he didn't want to put them in danger.
How do you do that? How do you in a sense go to work? And be out in the public and keep your family protected.
I think he claimed he had a rural chicken business that would take him away. I suspect he always suspected that he had two wives that they both actually knew what he was doing, but wouldn't bring it up and allowed him to kind of maintain the dignity of his lie. It was an interesting setup he had, but as far as I know,
it worked.
It worked, yes.
And where is he today? Do you know?
We exchanged Facebook messages a couple years ago, and I believe he's still over there. Said he's doing well.
In Baghdad or around Baghdad?
In Baghdad, yeah. And it's far enough in Baghdad that the Islamic State has not gotten that far. But that doesn't mean that there's still not a lot of sectarian violence occurring. So, no, I think about him and his family a lot.
Yeah, and worry, I would assume, as well.
Of course. And, you tell him, let me know how I can ever help. But, I've reflected on those words were sincere, but also a bit hollow. Because if you were to reach out, I will do the best I can, but I'm not an army captain anymore. I'm just a citizen on the other side of the globe. So I think this is something that many service members of my generation have dealt with in their own ways.
Well, I'm glad you said that. I've interviewed a number of journalists who have had interpreters. Some have been trying, frankly, for years to try to get them into the country, and the red tape, the bureaucracy, the logistics, all of that has just made it incredibly difficult, and in certain cases impossible to get this person who they relied on so much when they were in Iraq, who frankly put their life on the line for a journalist or this country, and they're stuck.
It's a great national shame that I think more people need to know about the way that these allies and interpreters risk their lives for our country in ways that most American citizens haven't been abandoned. And, you know, it's not just a matter of us not being there and taking, you know, the war machine no longer giving them a livelihood. It's that their lives are at risk.
Because they're associated or could be associated with the United States.
Absolutely. And become targets that way. And their families become targets that way. And there are documented cases in both Iraq and Afghanistan of interpreters and their family members ending up dead and serving as warnings as part of the sectarian violence. And you know, there are some great nonprofits such as the LIST Project that are devoted to kind of trying to get as many of our former interpreters and allies stateside, and they do a good job in that regard. But I think the backlogs are just so immense that it's just a really small offering compared to what could and should be occurring.
Without giving too much away, it seems Kasim, your interpreter in this novel, does okay. I mean, he survives, and he's in Beirut, right?
By the end? Yes. There weren't too many characters that were going to get or even necessarily deserved something resembling a happy ending, but Snoop definitely did. The fact that if nothing else, he gets out of sectarian Iraq, is a victory in and of itself. But he has to leave some people and a life behind in the process.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Matt Gallagher is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's been a guest before, in fact, talking about a collection of short stories that he co-edited a couple of years ago. He's now a novelist. His first novel is called Youngblood. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Matt Gallagher about his new novel called Young Blood. It is based in Iraq, and it's about a platoon leader in Iraq as the war is winding down. And I should add that our guest, Matt Gallagher, was an Army platoon leader from 2007 to the beginning of 2009, stationed outside of Baghdad in Iraq. Do you think there's something about war that creates sometimes really subversive language that is often very colorful, some of which we can't say on the radio, but is fodder for someone who's a writer and specifically now a novelist?
I think so. The military's distortion of language is fascinating just from a linguistic perspective. It's doing its best to almost dehumanize the experience, something as basic as calling a roadside bomb an IED, right? It makes it technical. It makes it, it makes it easier to say on the radio.
Sure.
But it also, makes it less frightening. So then, as writers, whatever their background, be them veterans or civilians, decide upon this as a subject, yes, it's just perfect fodder to explore in prose because there's a built-in irony. There's a built-in dark humor there. There's also a built-in spareness that is so often associated with fine writing. So it makes a lot of sense. There's some universalities to that language from generation to generation, but then there are obviously very specifics to that. And I wanted to kind of get some finer texture and textual details of the Iraq experience. Using that in my language was important.
And can you say some of those words on the air? And I know this was part of Kaboom, your blog as well.
Sure.
And your memoir.
Sure. Even the word Kaboom, I think, is a good example. It was maybe it's not as funny now, but at the time when I started my blog in 2007, I was 23. I was a young person, but I'd already lost some friends to roadside bomb attacks, to IED attacks. Wow. And as I was trying to figure out what I'd call my blog, as I was getting over there to keep in touch with family and friends, I thought it was kind of an irreverent, cheeky reference to that. And it was, looking back on it, I don't even know if I was conscious of it at the time. It was, I think, an attempt to maintain some sense of, the individual person that I was at that time. You know, I was still very much kind of an irreverent, fresh out of college kid, and using that on my blog, it was an expression of that.
Well, it's a kind of a gallows humor, a PFC cold cuts that was an emotional soldier. I'm looking actually at a review of your memoir, Stun Gun Dubbed Cultural Awareness.
Right, right.
I mean, that sort of gives you a flavor for the kind of dark humor, irreverent humor.
Right. And you know, sometimes I think readers who aren't familiar with that use of humor or military culture find it almost dehumanizing or inhumane, and I always try to push back and say it's actually the most humane thing in the world. It's a defense mechanism. It's a way to keep going. People needed to tell September 11th jokes in the aftermath of 9/11, because if you get bogged down in the immensity of tragedy and ruin, how do you go on? There's a scene in Youngblood where a group of young soldiers come across the aftermath of a car bomb attack, and they kind of joke around with each other in the moment because they need to keep going on this patrol. But that doesn't mean that what they're seeing there and taking in won't linger within all of them for years. Of course it will, and it won't be a laughing matter. But in that moment, with each other, trying to prove to one another that they're tougher than the next guy and that can keep going, it's the most humane thing in the world to try to make a humorous joke out of the awful tragedy that they're bearing witness to.
Do you ever get frustrated that while the war was going on, it didn't have the kind of coverage? I mean, it had a lot of coverage, but a kind of at a distance coverage. And now that the war is sort of officially over, soldiers have come back, like yourself, and people have moved on.
It's frustrating as a citizen, as a person, as somebody that spent a very formative time of my youth over there trying to bring stability to a community. But it's also, I think, an opportunity as a writer, that's what I have tried to convey in my writing, that the American military experience in Iraq is much more than the invasion or the mission accomplished banner or the general betray us ad. There was a dynamic, vibrant human aspect of this that left many Iraqis dead, many more displaced, that took the youth and the lives of thousands of American soldiers and Marines. Capturing that, that war is futile is an old truth,
sure.
But it's also, of course, it's one worth restating over and over again, because for whatever reason, it continues to happen every generation, until it's not part of the human condition, it is. Even though it's very easy to feel otherwise in within the safety of post-empire America.
Are you anti-war? I mean, would you describe yourself that way?
I'll give you a very writerly answer to that.
Go
and
ahead.
Say yes and no. yes, in the way that, as any thinking human being should be. And I think Youngblood is an anti-war, or is certainly anti-carrying out of the Iraq War novel in that regard. To paraphrase Kurt Vonnegut, you might as well write an anti-glacier book.
Inevitable.
Right. Well, I mean, this is pre-climate change, so that joke might not last another couple generations. But there is kind of a sense of inevitability to it. And so in that way, in kind of the lazy, reflexive way we use, or some people in society use anti-war, I don't think so. Because, I mean, that's like saying I'm anti-poverty or I'm anti-misery. Well, yeah, but, how do we as individuals, and how do we as a people go about to bringing an end to it? I don't consider myself a pacifist by any means. So in that way, I wouldn't describe myself as anti-war.
Porter is told near the end of his tour there, your war is over. And I guess one wonders, for someone like your character, even maybe like yourself, whether that ever happens, whether that war, your war is ever over.
Mine, mine was the day I came home, for better or for worse. I think becoming a writer and now writing has helped in that. And I think, like I maybe mentioned earlier, I've always been able to compartmentalize. And I had a very blessed tour. I came back with all my fingers and toes, my mental faculties. I went back to grad school. Jack is going to have a much tougher road, I suspect. And if I were Jack's parents or a friend, I'd be deeply concerned, because the way things stick to him and the way he chews them over and never lets go. But as a writer and having him as a narrator, it was good. Because it allowed me to go some really deep, dark places. A novel about the Iraq War needs to go to those deep, dark places, I think.
Do you think we, meaning the civilian population, has a skewed view for veterans that either they're homeless on the streets, they have PTSD, maybe they run for president or they run for some kind of elective office, and that there are what sounds like veterans like yourself who are doing okay?
Yeah, I mean, it runs the gamut. We're human beings.
But then we have this idea that veterans are either heroes or they're
victims.
Suffering or victims. Yes.
Right. Heroes, monsters, or victims, I think, are the three easy stereotypes. Unfortunately, sometimes some people fall into those traps. But I really can't stress enough how in the minority they are. I mean, we're whether somebody went to war or not, we're all heroes some days, we're all monsters some days, we're all victims other days, right? That's just part of being a human being. So conveying sometimes to people who don't know any vets themselves that we run the gamut in that way, every strata of American society, can be frustrating as a person, but again, it's on us as writers interested in these topics, interested in the military-civilian divide, interested in how American foreign policy looks overseas, but also how it looks back here on the home front. That's an opportunity try, I hope whatever somebody's preconceived notions are, if they give young blood a read or give an essay a read, that something has been added to defy those preconceived notions. Maybe it's not what I intended, but that's okay too. As long as it's maybe a little more full dimensional understanding of these topics and issues, what more could any writer want?
This is a sort of weirdly policy or strategy question. I mean, there was talk about sending military troops back to some of these war zones in the Middle East. And certainly with the rise of ISIS threatening the local population, potentially threatening the United States and certainly some other countries as well. How do you think about that stuff? How do you even wrestle with it? Or how much do you think about it?
Probably more than I should. I'm a citizen of a republic. I think we all should be wrestling with these issues. Certainly being a veteran is part of the reason I do, but mostly because I just care about being an engaged part of this country. My view of it is, if we learned anything from Iraq, and I'm not convinced that we did, it's that the what then question has to be answered before any kind of serious ground invasion. That's just not something you can figure out in the midst of it, because you've already lost sight of the end goal. So when I hear talking heads or neocons making noise about ending ISIS through a ground invasion, but then being able to even broach the what then question, I get deeply frustrated, and then throw in the fact that a Western invasion is part of kind of ISIS's whole apocalyptic vision. It would just kind of be a candle for every wannabe jihadist on the planet. I'm no Clausewitz, but I do know that we shouldn't do exactly what the enemy wants us to do. I think we're getting reports now that ISIS is learning what we learned last decade, and what the British and Ottomans had learned decades before, that war in that region is very, very easy. it's governing that's hard. So that's my view of it as a citizen first and as a veteran second.
I'd love to have you read. This is a poem that you included at the very beginning of your book, a poem by Stephen Crane. I'd love to have you read it, and then I want to know why you included it.
Sure. In the desert, I saw a creature, naked, bestial, who, squatting upon the ground, held his heart in his hands and ate of it. I said, "Is it good, friend?" "It is bitter, bitter," he answered. "But I like it because it is bitter and because it is my heart."
Wow.
Yeah, it's a really good poem.
It is a really good poem.
Yeah. No.
Why did you want to include that? I mean, I think I know the answer, but I want to hear it from you.
Well, for a few reasons. Growing up, I loved Crane's work. He's most famous for The Red Badge of Courage, of course. I consider him kind of the godfather of American war literature. Many of the things that we associate with Hemingway, the spare prose, the subtext. Hemingway kind of reappropriated a generation later from Crane. I thought that Youngblood was, my small offering to this really proud tradition of American war literature. So I wanted to pay reverence to Crane in that way. But then the context of the poem, I think that ambiguous dichotomous relationship to one's inner being reflects on a lot of the characters, certainly Jack and Jack's journey, but also Chambers. By the end of it, I think Chambers, you have a better sense of the duality of Chambers, and certainly the Sheik's daughter Rana, who's a primary character of the book, is reflected in those words. Yeah. So it's a poem that I've long loved, but using it as the epigraph was ideal. It was ideal.
And what an image of someone, in a sense, eating their own heart.
Eating their own heart and finding it, finding the bitterness in it, but then still embracing it because it's theirs, right? And I think one that hasn't had to have gone to Iraq or been in combat to understand the image there and the complexity therein.
We're almost out of time here. Do you imagine writing another book that's based in some way in Iraq or about Iraq? Do you know the answer to that?
I don't want to say never, it's certainly not something that I think I'll explore in my writing anytime soon. I've said all I can say on the war and my experiences in it, and then my fictional reimagining of it. So I'm looking forward to moving on to some other things. But, who knows? Who knows what the future holds?
Well, on that note, Matt Gallagher, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Appreciate it, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, his new book, his first novel has been published, and it's called Youngblood. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.